And now, Paul Gambaccini presents The David Bowie Story, Part 4, Don't Normalize It. Of 1976, David Bowie's personal life was in great danger of disintegrating into a farrago of Hollywood insanity, though perversely, his career was more buoyant than ever. The hit singles Fame and Golden Years had consolidated his reputation as one of rock's most innovative craftsmen. And despite another unpredictable change of direction, his latest album, Station to Station, was heading towards the top five in both Britain and America.
I think the biggest influence on that album was the work of Kraftwerk prior to Autobahn. And the new German sound was really appealing to me. Can, Edward Froese's band, Tangerine Dream. Not that band so much, but Edgar's stuff. Edgar's solo things were really, I thought, were very evocative. And there was this ambient thing that was happening, because Edgar had an album out called Something in Malaysian Pale. And it was, as far as I'm concerned, the first ambient music. It was just extraordinary album. Very quiet. You could only just hear it, you know. And I tried to apply some of the randomness on, again, because I associated with it immediately because of my interest in random sound and what you could do with this random sound. And I utilized a lot of that feeling for especially the title track, Station Station.
Bowie's interest in contemporary German music and his growing fascination with European history and culture was reflected in the Station to Station tour, in which he adopted the persona of the thin white Duke. Starkly dressed in crisp black and white and with hair scraped back, Bowie prowled across a harshly lit monochrome stage set, similar to the one which had entranced him in the musical Cabaret 8 years earlier. To extend this European mood, he dispensed with a traditional support act in favor of showing the surrealist movie Un Chien Andalou, made by Luis Buñuel and Salvador Dali. The film's most striking sequence was a razor blade drawn across an eyeball.
It was incredible because I knew exactly how long we had before I was due to go on, because when that eyeball was cut, the whole audience went, "Whoa!" I thought, 15 minutes, lads. It was like, you know, an alarm call. I don't think they'd seen anything like it in their lives, because, I mean, there was very little on American cinema that resembled that, and that was made, I don't know, 1923 maybe, something like that. It was the most extraordinary film, you know. There was something so graphic about the Brunel piece, you know, the priests being dragged along with the dead horses and the piano and all that. It was like, whoa, get a load of this and make sense of it.
Perhaps the Thin White Duke tour could more accurately have been called the Thin White Line tour, with Bowie unable to resist the drug dealers who had latched on to their best customer.
They'd fly in because they knew that I was sort of a, you know, a good customer. So it was very hard to ditch them, but it was taking its toll, and I just did too much, and I came close several times to overdosing, and it was really graphically clear that I was on. It was like being in a car where the steering had gone out of control and you were going towards the edge of a cliff, and whatever you did with the wheel, it was inevitable that you'd be going to go over the edge. And I just felt like that. I just felt I'd almost resigned myself to the fact that I'm going over the edge, you know, I'm not going to be able to stop, and it's it. And I started really getting very, very worried for my life, you know, and I just had to get myself out of that situation. So I ended up in Berlin, the smack capital of Europe. Again, I really didn't have any idea until I got there that that's in fact what it was. And who did I take with me? Iggy Pop, who was trying to get off smack. So the two of us were like over there. But we actually did very well. We were very successful because I think we got ourselves out of that cluster of dreadful people that we found we'd been surrounded with. You know, it was like, well, it's our own fault. We'd encouraged them and they were there. And so it's nobody's responsibility but our own. But it was a way of kind of really cleaning up our act. And it was a long, slow climb back up again, you know. It was very hard.
Yeah.
China Girl by Iggy Pop. After spending the summer producing Iggy's album, The Idiot, Bowie invited an ill-assorted but strangely compatible bunch of musicians to the Chateau d'Hérouville studio outside Paris to start work on what many now consider to be his finest album, Low. Among those he hoped would introduce an unconventional element to the proceedings was Brian Eno, who, since his pioneering days with Roxy Music, had developed a unique strand of experimental music.
What I think he was trying to do was to duck the momentum of a successful career. You know, the main problem with success is that it is a huge momentum. It's like you've got this big train behind you, and it all wants you to carry on going the same way. Nobody wants you to step off the tracks and start looking around in the scrub around the edges, you know, because nobody can see anything promising there. Of course they can't. It's not their job to see that. And I think he could, and he started certainly on Station to Station. I felt, well, I think that's just such an innovative record. I can say that because I have nothing to do with it whatsoever. I think the other ones are as well, but people would say, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? You know, but that record really indicates to me that he had a nose for the future, you know. And, yeah, I think he certainly did want to be with someone who he felt also had that and was keen to encourage that and to say, don't worry, there's something at the end of this, you know, there's, it doesn't fizzle out. It's worth working on. There's something to go for. I did take my little synthesizer, but at that time I wasn't, still now really, I wasn't really a musician in the sense of someone who went in and played things. What I always did in the studio and what I still do now is to go in and try to think about the music and to sit back from it and say, well, what is this music? Where is it located? What's its form? What could its form be? I mean, I certainly know one of the things I did on that record, which I think was important, was to encourage him. Now, that seems like quite a straightforward thing, but now here he was coming up with these strange short and long pieces of music, pieces that had original forms and structures. And the first thing I wanted to say was leave the forms as strange as they are. For instance, the song Breaking Glass, it was only that long because that little jam that it came from happened to be that long. Now, the feeling around was that, oh, we'd edit it together and we'd do something with it and turn it into a more normal structure. And I said, no, don't. Leave it being abnormal. Leave it strange. Don't normalize it, you know. This is what I always find myself saying to people, don't normalize it. If it's like that and you like it, keep it. Why fix it? It's not broken, you know. That's what I think I do when I work with people. I generally encourage them to be different if I can.
After a one-album absence, Tony Visconti was back in the producer's chair, starting his third spell as Bowie's confidant.
David was going through great personal problems, professional problems. Two things were happening simultaneously on that album. He was splitting up with Angela. It was the end of his days with Angie. And every time we'd really get stuck into something, there'd be a phone call from Angela that would completely upset him. He'd be devastated for hours. The other thing that was going on was he was getting out of his agreement with Michael Lipman, his then manager, his current manager, and they were doing a deposition or something in Paris. So every morning David would have to go to some Paris hotel where his new lawyers were battling Michael Lipman. Michael Lipman would be in another room and David would be in this room with his lawyers, and I had to go at David's request. Please, as my mate, will you come and just be there? So it was a tragic period of his life. I mean, I really feel sorry for him, what he had to go through to split up with a wife and a manager at the same time. Probably what it looked like to him was he was just going to lose all his money. If Angela wasn't going to take it all, certainly Michael Lipman was. And that's the way it looked. I'm not saying that's what happened. But being through a divorce myself, it can be a very bleak, you know, horrendous experience. You know, it involves children too. You know, David has a boy that he's very fond of. So, he was low.
When David had to go to Paris to conduct this court case. So the studio was booked, you see, it was 24 hours a day booking. And he said, well, it's there, you might as well use it. And so I made a deal with him. I said, look, I'll start on something. If you don't like it, if it's no use for this record, I'll use it for my record and pay for the studio time. I thought this was the best deal I could offer. And so when he came back, I had got that piece musically pretty much finished, actually. It was musically a whole thing, as you hear it now. What he did then was something that really took me by surprise, was he added vocals to it. I'd never thought of doing that to a track like that before. And of course he added vocalese vocals, you know, there's no language there, but it sounds like a language. It's a great triumph, I think, to pull that one off convincingly.
Studio. I'd never used a studio in quite the way that Brian was using it, where he would pre-effect an instrument and it would go onto tape already with an effect on it, whereas I would always want to keep an instrument dry and then put the effect on afterwards during the mixing stage so that I felt that I had control over the effect. Where Brian said, boy, I like that echo, let's keep that echo on it, put it to tape. So you were stuck with it, you couldn't change it, you know. And it was, I'd never worked like that before. That was kind of a bit dangerous, you know. It was, well, suppose we want to change our minds. No, we don't have to change our minds. Our mind has been made up for us. You know, it's like, oh, all right, okay, well, we'll just go with this and see what happens. And then we would devise systems where I would put down a piano part, say, and then take the faders down so that you could only hear the drums, and he knew only what key it was in. Then he would come in and put an alternative piece in, not hearing my part, but knowing what the key was. And then we leapfrog with each other, not hearing each other's parts, and at the end of the day put all the parts up and see what happened, see what it was like. So, oh, parts 3, 7 and 5 sound great. So we took all the rest down, we just had fader 3, 5 and 7, and that would become the basis for that song. You know, all these wonderful sort of approaches, like musically, really musically cutting up, they produce some extraordinary things. We did quite a few experiments like that, and some of them worked very well. Another rather similar experiment, I had this pack of cards called Oblique Strategies, and we would each take one of those, but we'd keep it secret, right? Each oblique strategy sort of tells you a way of operating. It's a sort of a technique on each card. And then we'd each start working on the same piece of music, but with entirely separate and secret agendas. So, for instance, I'm trying to remember, there was one very funny pair. We just cracked up laughing when we, at the end of working on this piece, we revealed them, because they instructed us to do completely contrary things. For example, one of them said, make something as quiet and discreet as possible, and the other would say,
make a horrible mess or something like that, you know. And so there were the two of us trying to pull this thing in completely different directions. And of course, this can make for a great composition when there's that kind of tension in it.
David loves anything like that. Any element of chance that you can throw into it, because David's very much an on-the-spot, spontaneous creator. He finds it very hard to sit up all night long and write a song up in the garret. You know, he has to have conditions like this to create. So Brian was perfect for that, to be in the studio. Brian was always the little Zen master who would pull out another card or another trick or another idea, and some of them were ridiculously stupid, but the ones that worked were really great, really ingenious. He was always present, and he always had something useful to say. He carries around these little black books full of information, and if I say something or anything happens in the studio, something technical or something artistic or anything, it goes in his little book. And at the time, he had 40 volumes of these little books full of information. And when we were stuck for an idea, he would just like back up about 30 pages and say, "Oh, let's try this." We had nothing to record. There were no songs written. I think Sound and Vision was a jam. It was just a set of chord changes. I remember my ex-wife Mary Hopkin and Brian Eno did that little melody at the beginning, a bit before the vocal comes in. That was written long before the lyrics were written. I mean, that was finished weeks before David came up with some set of lyrics to the song or even a tune. Of the album were really great. When he finished the vocal of Sound and Vision and we knew it was a hit, that was fantastic. You know, out of all this glumness and this terrible bleak goings on all around us, to have those highlights, and they were incredibly high, as well as the lows being incredibly low. One night when we realized we had an album, David clutched the cassette in his hand and he says, "We've got it, we've got it," because it didn't look like we had anything on tape until about 3 weeks since the recording.
Was a miracle for me. I mean, but the thing that was most exciting about it all is that I found that without drugs I was still writing very well, you know, and that was probably the most rejuvenating aspect of it all, is that you don't need to get stoned out of your gourd to write well, you know. If you were a good writer to begin with, you're still going to be able to write. So that was wonderful. Realizing that it was possible to survive all that and not become a casualty, I think, was just such an eye-opener to me. And it was literally like being reborn. I think that was, you know, it was an incredibly important period for me. I can't say it was like night and day that suddenly I was just a different person. It wasn't. It took quite a long time. I think, you know, it takes many years to psychologically try and put back the pieces. But I think, you know, I did see light at the end of the tunnel, and it wasn't a train. We'll be right back.
when Low was re-released just a few months ago, I listened to it again. I hadn't for ages. And I thought, boy, what a really good record this was. And I wrote to David and said, I'm sure any band could have taken one of these, just one of these pieces of music and based a whole career on it, you know. Because there were so many possibilities sort of pregnant in that album. And that, for me, makes a great record. I'm not really interested in finished, polished, wonderful, slick, glossy pieces of work. They're the end of a story for me. What I'm interested in is seeing something that is just bristling with sort of excitement, and it's really alive, and you know that things are going to come from that, you know, that something else will ensue. And I felt that with Station to Station, and certainly with Low. I was very happy with Low when it was finished.
The experience of recording Low had been so invigorating that Bowie had little trouble persuading Brian Eno and Tony Visconti to work with him again on the follow-up album, Heroes. This was recorded at Hansa Studio in Berlin. Tony Visconti.
Hansa by the Wall, their main studio, Studio A, was a converted theater. Or it was some kind of a concert hall, that room, at one time. I don't think it was built to be studio at first, but it was adapted to be a studio. And we couldn't see that room from the control room. It was on closed circuit television. But what we could see from the console was we would face East Berlin, and we would see the wall at every moment of work. And on the wall would be mounted a turret, a gun turret, with three East German guards. And they'd be looking into the control room with these big, powerful binoculars. And they'd watch us work every day. So it was a bit unnerving to watch these guys who had the firing power. They could certainly shoot across the wall and get us through the windows if they wanted to. It was that close.
Brian Eno.
You'd see the soldiers on the towers. But, I mean, I don't think anyone for one moment thought they were going to start taking pot shots necessarily. But it certainly added a thread to the sort of geography of the record, in that we were in a place with a very strong personality. And I suppose the way that translates is in making you think you're going to do something strong as well. You know, it's no use releasing something mediocre or pallid in an atmosphere like that. You tend to make strong statements then. I think that record took a month, Heroes, which is pretty good going, because that did include writing. So from, as far as I know, from the very beginning to the very end, it took a month. I don't think there was much material prepared before. And an example of the kind of speed at which we were working was during the record, I said, you know, it'd be really good if Fripp played on some of these. I'd, of course, worked with Fripp quite a lot by then. So we rang up Fripp, who was living in New York at the time, and he got on a plane, arrived in Berlin, and drove into the studio. Now, I already knew, of course, how Fripp works well. and I know he is great when you surprise him. And so he came in straight off the plane, and he set up. We'd put the song on. These are songs he'd never heard. We'd told him nothing about them. He didn't know what the chords were going to do, what the changes were going to be or anything. And some of them had rather awkward changes. And he would just launch into them at full speed and somehow navigate his way through them. Now, you have to be very, very, very good to do that. So we did pretty much all of the recording of Fripp, which is a pretty major part of this record, on that first evening.
Just a piano piece, it really doesn't say anything much to me. Fripp's plaintive guitar cry that went through it, that really triggered off something emotive in me, and it was a song of triumph, and it was like, I've been a real idiot some of my life and put myself in ridiculously dangerous situations psychologically, you know, and I seem to have been getting through it. And that became part and parcel of that song, is that, you know, you can overcome some incredible odds. By him finally finding some peace in his life. He had been through the divorce, or it was going well anyway. Probably for one of the few times in his life, he was really comfortable being himself. And without taking too much credit for it, I had met this lovely German girl, and we were walking by the wall while he was sort of stuck for ideas, and we were written into the song. I saw them standing by the wall. It was me and this girl, Antonia Maas, who is the backing vocalist on Beauty and the Beast. So we were going for a walk by the wall and holding hands and all that. We got written into the song. We'll be right back.
that's the difference between David and most of the other people that I worked with. David would go to a city and lap up all the culture possible. He would see everything you can possibly see in that city. Whereas when I worked with Mark Bolan, he would stay in his hotel room the whole time, maybe go to one club and then tell everyone how what a drag that club was and go back to his hotel and write some more songs. So David really took full advantage of wherever he was geographically. And David knew where to go. Being with David Bowie is like having a ticket to the most fun places that exist. I mean, the doors open for him everywhere. David knows where to go. He knows the hottest places. So we were going out every night to some amazing place. But the most bizarre place we went to was a place called the Lutzauer Lampe, which means some kind of a light. I don't know. My German's not that good. But this place is in a derelict, bombed-out street. Virtually every house on that street was abandoned except for this one metal door, and you knock on this door. I mean, there's just no cars, nothing, no lights in the windows, nothing. You knock on this door and a little peephole opens up and you hear this voice that says, "Yeah," and you go, "Well, we're the Jones party." David was calling himself David Jones at the time, making reservations under that name. And he says, "Oh yeah, guten Abend, come in." And the door would open up, and this would be a guy in drag, not making any attempt to disguise his voice. And this person's name was Daisy. And we'd go in, and Daisy would greet us. Daisy was remarkable, a cross-eyed ex-sailor who is now a drag queen and the kind of the bouncer of the club. I thought that was bizarre in itself. You know, David met all these strange people, and it was our city for the making of that album.
From Heroes, produced once again by Tony Visconti. Brian Eno.
Visconti was very important because some of these tracks, by this time, since they were so vague in a way in their identity was being formed all the time as we worked on them. It wasn't like someone had done a demo and we knew what we were going to end up with, a better version of that demo. No, these things were evolving as we worked on them. And in the course of their evolution, all sorts of junk went on the tape, you know, because for a while it would take on this other identity, but then it would go back that way or something. But these little leftover pieces would still be on the tape. We didn't want to erase them yet because we didn't know whether that was how they should be or not. So there are all these sort of vestigial performances on the tape, and Visconti, I thought, mixed those things absolutely brilliantly because he somehow managed to weave together a lot of stuff that was so exotic and, in a sense, awkward to fit into what sounds like convincing pieces of music. You know, you hear those things and you think, oh, of course, must have been there all the time. Visconti was very important to that. In fact, I always feel rather bad that I think I get more credit than I should in relation to him, because I think Visconti was very important.
During this phase of his career, Bowie was creating most of his lyrics spontaneously, juggling random ideas and fragments suggested by the musical landscapes built up in the studio. But one track on Heroes, Joe the Lion, continued his obsession with the nonconformists working at the fringes of their art.
There was a performance artist called Chris Burden who would do kinds of things like he would have himself hung over a great pool of water with two electrodes in his hand, and if he let his hands down, he'd automatically be electrocuted. So he had to, like, be supported there for hour after hour with his hands up in the air, you know, and this was a kind of, again, one of these statements on what is just a physical discomfort and what is art. Well, one of the most amazing things he did, he had himself put in a bag, sewn into a bag, like a post bag, and then put in the middle of a freeway between the two lanes of traffic. And he was there for like 2 or 3 hours, and nothing ran over him. I mean, he did the most extraordinary things. Absolutely extraordinary. He had somebody shoot him, I know. Somebody came in about 10 yards, they shot a rifle into his chest. I mean, he's an extraordinary guy. And one of the things he did was have himself nailed to a Volkswagen and driven out of his garage, shown as a crucifixion, and then it's called Crucifixion on a Volkswagen. So he appealed to me as being sort of an all-time fringe man. He went in there with Vince Taylor and Sid Barrett for me. I was like, what a collection. You've got them all in one room. What a cocktail party that would be. And he became part and parcel of Joe the Lion. He was Joe the Lion, you know. Nail me to my car and I'll tell you who you are. Are you man enough to watch this?
Had been an extraordinarily prolific year for Bowie, with the release of Low and Heroes and the two albums he'd produced for Iggy Pop. After a long concert tour, documented on the double album Stage, he retreated to Montreux in Switzerland to record Lodger, his third collaboration with Brian Eno.
As far as I'm concerned, this is the least successful of those three records. I think for several different reasons, actually. In some senses, the theme that we had opened up on the first two had kind of played out a little bit, and it would have been sensible to stop and think a little bit longer. This record, I felt, was rather made out of necessity, you know, time to make a record, got to do one, that kind of necessity, rather than the other kind of necessity which says, I've got a great idea, I've got a feeling that I want to find on a record somehow. So in some senses, the actual creation of this record was more experimental, but it was experimental in a funny way. It was experimental through the lack of other ways of driving it.
It's almost a notebook, I think, Lodger, and I think a lot of our contemporaries drew upon that album as a source book of kind of... There's a lot of things which led to the idea of world music on it, and even the fracturing of lyrics and speeding of lyrics, things like African Night Flight, have a kind of a British middle-class rap feel about them. And a lot of the percussive elements were really strange, and the idea of using Turkish-influenced music against... rock lyrics was kind of, I don't know, we did really did play around a lot on it. We got the band to do some extraordinary things. Because we would take like 7 chords and stick them on the blackboard, and then Brian would have a pointer and just the musician just have to play the chord he was pointing at, you know. So I got some very angry faces out there. I thought, what are we being, what is this? You know, we've been treated like school children here. Are they putting one on us? I think possibly we were.
One of those musicians was guitarist Carlos Alomar, who had been Bowie's musical director since the days of Young Americans.
Now we're all looking at him with a pointer, and he's going to point at the chord that he wants us to play. So, okay, you're going to play 4 or 8 bars of what I tell you. So you would go A, dun 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 dun, 7 bars, 8 bars, and G flat, dun 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 dun, and now G diminished, dun 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 dun. The concept is a great concept, okay, but for musical integrity, he was just blowing my mind. Okay, he was just like, this is too stupid. Okay, I am musically trained. I want to play. I cannot have anybody pointing on stupid chords, which I think the chords are just stupid, you know. So I, above anyone else, I suppose I fought that the most.
Although he resisted that idea, Carlos was enthusiastic about the band swapping instruments to create an appropriate mood for Boys Keep Swinging.
It was too perfect. It was too perfect. When we did Boys Keep Swinging, my part was just perfect. I was playing a perfect guitar part. The drums were just perfect. They were doing all the fabulous fills. And the song wasn't about that. The song was about a relentless punk basement, young kids getting on instruments, young boys that are just beginning to do it. They can't play, but their enthusiasm will not be contained. You know, and that's the reason behind him saying, look, Carlos, go play the drums. But I can't play the drums. So, yeah, I know. Go play the drums, you know. Dennis, get off the drums and go play the bass, you know. And then everybody's laughing at each other, playing. I'm playing the drums, like, tackle, 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 you know, just, I don't know, 3 beats. But if you get one of these 17-year-old kids that practices after school, you know, all he is a hammerhead, tackle, 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 tackle. And that's just what he wanted. So when he heard it, it sounded more like a basement tape. Everybody just throwing together, 1, 2, 3, bam. Heaven loves you. The clouds are for you. Nothing stands in your way. When you're a boy. Those always fit you. Life is the top of the cherry. When you're a boy. When you're a boy. You can wear a uniform. When you're a boy. Other boys stand you up. You get a girl. There's a favorite thing when you're a boy.
Presented The David Bowie Story, co-written by Pete Frame and the series producer, Kevin Howlett. Next week, Bowie in the 80s, in part 5, Out of Characters, Into Speech.